referring to the Bay Area tech crowd in the 1960s and early 1970s, as well as the people in and around Stuart Brand's Whole Earth Network, had taken Hubbard LSD. Why were engineers in particular so taken with psychedelics? Schwartz, himself trained as an aerospace engineer, thinks it has to do with the fact that, unlike the work of scientists who can simplify the problems they work on, problem-solving in engineering always involves irreducible complexity. You're always balancing complex variables you can never get perfect, so you're desperately searching to find patterns. LSD shows you patterns. Says Schwartz, I have no doubt that all that Hubbard LSD all of us had taken had a big effect on the birth of Silicon Valley. Stuart Brand received his own baptism in Hubbard LSD at IFAS in 1962, with James Fadiman presiding as his guide. His first experience with LSD was kind of a bum trip, he recalls, but it led to a series of other journeys that reshaped his worldview and, indirectly, all of ours. The Whole Earth Network Brand would subsequently gather together, which included Peter Schwartz, Esther Dyson, Kevin Kelly, Howard Rheingold, and John Perry Barlow, and play a key role in redefining what computers meant and did, helping to transform them from a top-down tool of the military-industrial complex, with the computer punch card a handy symbol of organization man, into a tool of personal liberation and virtual community with a distinctly countercultural vibe. How much does the idea of cyberspace, an immaterial realm where one can construct a new identity and merge with a community of virtual others, owe to an imagination shaped by the experience of psychedelics? Or for that matter, virtual reality? The whole notion of cybernetics, the idea that material reality can be translated into bits of information, may also owe something to the experience of LSD, with its power to collapse matter into spirit. Brand thinks LSD's value to his community was as an instigator of creativity, one that first helped bring the power of networked computers to people via SRI computer visionaries such as Doug Engelbart and the early hacker community, but then was superseded by the computers themselves. At a certain point, the drugs weren't getting any better, Brand said, but the computers were. After his experience at IFAS, Brand got involved with Ken Kesey and his notorious acid tests, which he describes as a participatory art form that led directly to Burning Man, the annual gathering of the arts, technology, and psychedelic communities in the Nevada desert. In his view, LSD was a critical ingredient in nourishing the spirit of collaborative experiment and tolerance of failure that distinguished the computer culture of the West Coast. It gave us permission to try weird shit in cahoots with other people. On occasion, the LSD produced genuine insight, as it did for Brand himself one chilly afternoon in the spring of 1966. Bored, he went up on the roof of his building in North Beach and took 100 micrograms of acid, Fadiman's creativity dose. As he looked toward downtown while wrapped in a blanket, it appeared that the streets lined with buildings were not quite parallel. This must be due to the curvature of the Earth, Brand decided. It occurred to him that when we think of Earth as flat, as we usually do, we assume it is infinite, and we treat its resources that way. The relationship to infinity is to use it up, he thought. But around Earth was a finite spaceship you had to manage carefully. At least that's how it appeared to him that afternoon, from 3 stories and 100 mics up. It would change everything if he could convey this to people. But how? He flashed on the space program and wondered, why haven't we seen a picture of the Earth from space? I become fixed on this, on how to get this photo that would revolutionize our understanding of our place in the universe. I know, I'll make a button. But what should it say? Let's have a photo of the Earth from space. No, it needs to be a question, maybe a little paranoid. Draw on that American resource. Why haven't we seen a photograph of the whole Earth yet? Brand came down from his roof and launched a campaign that eventually reached the halls of Congress and NASA. Who knows if it was the direct result of Brand's campaign, but 2 years later, in 1968, the Apollo astronauts turned their cameras around and gave us the first photograph of Earth from the moon. And Stuart Brand gave us the first edition of the Whole Earth catalog. Did everything change? The case could be made that it had. Part 2, The Crack-Up. Timothy Leary came late to psychedelics. By the time he launched the Harvard Psilocybin Project in 1960, there had already been a full decade of psychedelic research in North America, with hundreds of academic papers and several international conferences to show for it. Leary himself seldom made reference to this body of work, preferring to give the impression that his own psychedelic research represented a radical new chapter in the annals of psychology. In 1960, the future of psychedelic research looked bright. Yet within the brief span of 5 years, the political and cultural weather completely shifted. A moral panic about LSD engulfed America, and virtually all psychedelic research and therapy were either halted or driven underground. What happened? Timothy Leary is the too obvious answer to that question. Just about everyone I've interviewed on the subject, dozens of people, has prefaced his or her answer by saying, "It's far too easy to blame Leary," before proceeding to do precisely that. It's hard to avoid the conclusion that the flamboyant psychology professor, with a tropism bending him toward the sun of publicity, good or bad, did grave damage to the cause of psychedelic research. He did. And yet, the social forces unleashed by the drugs themselves, once they moved from the laboratory out into the culture, were bigger and stronger than any individual could withstand or take credit for. With or without the heedless, joyful, and amply publicized antics of Timothy Leary, the sheer Dionysian power of LSD was itself bound to shake things up and incite a reaction. By the time Leary was hired by Harvard in 1959, he had a national reputation as a gifted personality researcher. And yet even then, before his first shattering experience with psilocybin in Cuernavaca during the summer of 1960, Leary was feeling somewhat disenchanted with his field. A few years before, while working as director of psychiatric research at Kaiser Hospital in Oakland, Leary and a colleague had conducted a clever experiment to assess the effectiveness of psychotherapy. A group of patients seeking psychiatric care were divided into two groups. One received the standard treatment of the time, the other, consisting of people on a waiting list, no treatment at all. After a year, one-third of all the subjects had improved, one-third had gotten worse, and one-third remained unchanged, regardless of which group they were in. Whether or not a subject received treatment made no difference whatsoever in the outcome. So what good was conventional psychotherapy? Psychology? Leary had begun to wonder. Leary quickly established himself at Harvard's Department of Social Relations as a dynamic and charismatic, if somewhat cynical, teacher. The handsome professor was a great talker in the expansive Irish mode and could charm the pants off anyone, especially women, for whom he was apparently catnip. Leary had always had a roguish, rebellious streak. He was court-martialed during his time at West Point for violating the honor code and expelled from the University of Alabama for spending the night in a woman's dorm, and Harvard, the institution, brought out rebellion in him. Leary would speak cynically of psychological research as a game. Herbert Kelman, a colleague in the department who later became Leary's chief adversary, recalls the new professor as personable. Kelman helped him find his first house, but says, "I had misgivings about him from the beginning. He would often talk out of the top of his head about things he knew nothing about, like existentialism, and he was telling our students psychology was all a game. It seemed to me a bit cavalier and irresponsible." I met Kelman, now in his 90s, in the small, overstuffed apartment where he lives with his wife in an assisted living facility in West Cambridge. Kelman displayed no rancor toward Leary, yet evinced little respect for him, either as a teacher or as a scientist. Indeed, he believes Leary had become disenchanted with science well before psychedelics came into his life. In Kelman's opinion, even before the psilocybin, he was already halfway off the deep end. Leary's introduction to psilocybin, poolside in Mexico during the summer of 1960, came 3 years after R. Gordon Wasson published his notorious Life magazine article about the mushrooms that cause strange visions. For Leary, the mushrooms were transformative. In an afternoon, his passion to understand the human mind had been reignited, indeed had exploded. In 4 hours by the swimming pool in Cuernavaca, I learned more about the mind, the brain, and its structures than I did in the preceding 15 as a diligent psychologist, he wrote later in flashbacks, his 1983 memoir. I learned that the brain is an underutilized biocomputer. I learned that normal consciousness is one drop in an ocean of intelligence, that consciousness and intelligence can be systematically expanded, that the brain can be reprogrammed. Leary returned from his journey with an irresistible urge to rush back and tell everyone, as he recalled in High Priest, his 1968 memoir. And then in a handful of sentences, he slid into a prophetic voice, one in which the whole future trajectory of Timothy Leary could be foretold. Listen, wake up. You are God. You have the divine plan engraved in cellular script within you. Listen, take this sacrament. You'll see. You'll get the revelation. It will change your life. But at least for the first year or two at Harvard, Leary went through the motions of doing science. Back in Cambridge that fall, he recruited Richard Alpert, a promising assistant professor who was heir to a railroad fortune, and having secured the tacit approval of their department chair, David McClelland, the two launched the Harvard Psilocybin Project, operating out of a tiny broom closet of an office in the Department of Social Relations in a house at 5 Divinity Avenue. I went looking for the house, but it has long since been razed and replaced by a sprawling, block-long brick science building. Leary, ever the salesman, had convinced Harvard that the research he proposed to undertake was squarely in the tradition of William James, who in the early years of the century had also studied altered states of consciousness and mystical experience at Harvard. The university placed one condition on the research. Leary and Alpert could give the new drugs to graduate students, but not to undergraduates. Before long, an intriguingly titled new seminar showed up in the Harvard course listings. Experimental Expansion of Consciousness. The literature describing internally and externally induced changes in awareness will be reviewed. The basic elements of mystical experiences will be studied cross-culturally. The members of the seminar will participate in experiences with consciousness-expanding methods, and a systematic analysis of attention will be paid to the problems of methodology in this area. This seminar will be limited to advanced graduate students. Admission by consent of the instructor. Experimental expansion of consciousness proved to be extremely popular. In its 3 years of existence, the Harvard Psilocybin Project accomplished surprisingly little, at least in terms of science. In their first experiments, Leary and Alpert administered psilocybin to hundreds of people of all sorts, including housewives, musicians, artists, academics, writers, fellow psychologists, and graduate students, who then completed questionnaires about their experiences. According to the paper, Americans and Mushrooms in a Naturalistic Environment, a preliminary report, most subjects had generally very positive and occasionally life-changing experiences. Naturalistic was apt. These sessions took place not in university buildings, but in comfortable living rooms accompanied by music and candlelight, and to a casual observer, they would have looked more like parties than experiments, especially because the researchers themselves usually joined in. Leary and Alpert took a heroic amount of psilocybin and later LSD. At least in the beginning, Leary, Alpert, and their graduate students endeavored to write up accounts of their own and their subjects' psilocybin journeys, as if they were pioneers exploring an unmapped frontier of consciousness, and the previous decade of work surveying the psychedelic landscape had never happened. We were on our own, Leary wrote, somewhat disingenuously. Western literature had almost no guides, no maps, no texts that even recognized the existence of altered states. Drawing on their extensive fieldwork, however, Leary did do some original work theorizing the idea of set and setting, deploying the words in this context for the first time in the literature. These useful terms, if not the concepts they denote, for which Al Hubbard deserves most of the credit, may well represent Leary's most enduring contribution to psychedelic science. Leary and Alpert published a handful of papers in the early years at Harvard that are still worth reading, both as well-written and closely observed ethnographies of the experience, and as texts in which the early stirrings of a new sensibility can be glimpsed. Building on the idea that the life-changing experiences of volunteers in the Psilocybin Project might have some broader social application, in 1961, Leary and a graduate student, Ralph Metzner, dreamed up a more ambitious research project. The Concord Prison Experiment sought to discover if the potential of psilocybin to change personality could be used to reduce recidivism in a population of hardened criminals. That this audacious experiment ever got off the ground is a testimony to Leary's salesmanship and charm, for not only the prison psychiatrist but the warden had to sign off on it. The idea was to compare the recidivism rate of two groups of prisoners in a maximum security prison in Concord, Massachusetts. A group of 32 inmates received psilocybin in sessions that took place in the prison, with one member of Leary's team taking the drug with them, so as not to condescend to the prisoners, Leary explained, or treat them like guinea pigs. The other remained straight in order to observe and take notes. A second group of inmates received no drugs or special treatment of any kind. The two groups were then followed for a period of months after their release. Leary wrote in flashbacks that he was initially frightened to take psilocybin in a prison with violent criminals. When he confessed his fear to one of the prisoners, the inmate admitted he was afraid too. "Why are you afraid of me?" Leary asked, puzzled. "I'm afraid of you because you're a fucking mad scientist." Leary reported eye-popping results. 10 months after their release, only 25% of the psilocybin recipients had ended up back in jail, while the control group returned at a more typical rate of 80%. But when Rick Doblin at MAPS meticulously reconstructed the Concord experiment decades later, reviewing the outcomes subject by subject, he concluded that Leary had exaggerated the data. In fact, there was no significant difference in the rates of recidivism between the two groups. Even at the time, the methodological shortcomings of the study had prompted David McClellan, the department chair, to write a scathing memo to Metzner. Of Leary's scientific work, Sidney Cohen, himself a psychedelic researcher, concluded that it was the sort of research that made scientists wince. Leary played a more tangential role in one other, much more credible study done in the spring of 1962, the Good Friday experiment, described in Chapter 1. Unlike the Concord Prison Experiment, the Miracle at Marsh Chapel, as it became known, made a good-faith effort to honor the conventions of the controlled double-blind psychology experiment. Neither the investigators nor the subjects, 20 divinity students, were told who had gotten the drug and who had gotten the placebo, which was active. The Good Friday study was far from perfect. Pankey suppressed the fact that one subject freaked out and had to be sedated. Yet Pankey's main conclusion, that psilocybin can reliably occasion a mystical experience that is indistinguishable from, if not identical with, the experiences described in the literature, still stands and helped to inspire the current wave of research, particularly at Johns Hopkins, where it was replicated, roughly speaking, in 2006. But most of the credit for the Good Friday experiment rightfully belongs to Walter Pankey, not Timothy Leary, who was critical of its design from the start. He had told Pankey it was a waste of time to use a control group or a placebo. "If we learned one thing from that experience," Leary later wrote, "it was how foolish it was to use a double-blind experiment with psychedelics. After 5 minutes, no one's fooling anyone." By now, Leary had pretty much lost interest in doing science. He was getting ready to trade the psychology game for what he would call the guru game. Perhaps Leary's most endearing character trait was never to take himself too seriously, even as a guru. It had become clear to him that the spiritual and cultural import of psilocybin and LSD far outweighed any therapeutic benefit to individuals. As with Hubbard and Huxley and Osmond before him, psychedelics had convinced Leary that they had the power not just to heal people, but to change society and save humankind. And it was his mission to serve as their prophet. It was as though the chemicals themselves had hit upon a brilliant scheme for their own proliferation by colonizing the brains of a certain type of charismatic and messianic human. "We were thinking far-out history thoughts at Harvard," Leary later wrote about this period, "believing that it was time, after the shallow, nostalgic 50s, for far-out visions, knowing that America had run out of philosophy, that a new, empirical, tangible metaphysics was desperately needed." The bomb and the Cold War formed the crucial background to these ideas, investing the project with urgency. Leary was also encouraged in his shift from scientist to evangelist by some of the artists he turned on. In one notable session at his Newton home in December 1960, Leary gave psilocybin to the beat poet Allen Ginsberg, a man who needed no chemical inducement to play the role of visionary prophet. Toward the end of an ecstatic trip, Ginsberg stumbled downstairs, took off all his clothes, and announced his intention to march naked through the streets of Newton, preaching the new gospel. "We're going to teach people to stop hating," Ginsberg said, "start a peace and love movement." You can almost hear in his words the 1960s being born, the still damp, day-glow chick cracking out of its shell. When Leary managed to persuade Ginsberg not to leave the house, among other issues, it was December, the poet got on the phone and started dialing world leaders, trying to get Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Mao Zedong on the line to work out their differences. In the end, Ginsberg was only able to reach his friend Jack Kerouac, identifying himself as God, that's G-O-D, and telling him he must take these magic mushrooms, along with everyone else. Ginsberg was convinced that Leary, the Harvard professor, was the perfect man to lead the new psychedelic crusade. To Ginsberg, the fact that the new prophet should emerge from Harvard University, the alma mater of the newly elected president, was a case of historic comedy, for here was the one and only Dr. Leary, a respectable human being, a worldly man, faced with the task of a messiah. Coming from the great poet, the words landed like seeds on the fertile, well-watered soil of Timothy Leary's ego. It is one of the many paradoxes of psychedelics that these drugs can sponsor an ego-dissolving experience that in some people quickly leads to massive ego inflation. Having been let in on a great secret of the universe, the recipient of this knowledge is bound to feel special, chosen for great things. Huxley and Hubbard and Osmond shared Leary's sense of historical mission, but they had a very different idea of how best to fulfill it. The three were inclined to a more supply-side kind of spiritualism. First, you must turn on the elite, and then let the new consciousness filter down to the masses, who might not be ready to absorb such a shattering experience all at once. Their unspoken model was the Eleusinian Mysteries, in which the Greek elite gathered in secret to ingest the sacred Kykeion and share a night of revelation. But Leary and Ginsberg, both firmly in the American grain, were determined to democratize the visionary experience, make transcendence available to everyone now. Surely that was the great blessing of psychedelics. For the first time, there was a technology that made this possible. Years later, Lester Grinspoon, a Harvard professor of psychiatry, captured the ethos nicely in a book he wrote with James Bacalar, Psychedelic Drugs Reconsidered. Psychedelic drugs open to mass tourism mental territories previously explored only by small parties of particularly intrepid adventurers, mainly religious mystics, as well as visionary artists like William Blake, Walt Whitman, and Allen Ginsberg. Now, with a pill or a square of blotter paper, anyone could experience firsthand exactly what in the world Blake and Whitman were talking about. But this new form of spiritual mass tourism had not yet received much advertising or promotion before the spring of 1962. That's when news of controversy surrounding the Harvard psilocybin project first hit the newspapers, beginning with Harvard's own student paper, The Crimson. Harvard being Harvard and Leary Leary, the story quickly spread to the national press, turning the psychology professor into a celebrity and hastening his and Alpert's departure from Harvard in a scandal that both prefigured and helped fuel the backlash against psychedelics that would soon close down most research. Leary and Alpert's colleagues had been uncomfortable about the Harvard psilocybin project almost from the start. A 1961 memo from David McClellan had raised questions about the absence of controls in Leary and Alpert's naturalistic studies, as well as the lack of medical supervision and the fact that the investigators insisted on taking the drugs with their subjects, of whom there were hundreds. "How often should a person take psilocybin?" he asked, referring to Leary and Alpert. McClellan also called the two researchers out on their philosophical naivete. Many reports are given of deep mystical experiences, he wrote, but their chief characteristic is the wonder at one's own profundity. The following year, in a detailed critique of Ralph Metzner's Concord Prison experiment, McClellan accused the graduate student of failing to analyze your data objectively and carefully. You know what the conclusions are to be, and the data are simply used to support what you already know to be true. No doubt the popularity of the psilocybin project among the department's students, as well as its cliquishness, rankled the rest of the faculty, who had to compete with Leary and Alpert and their drugs for a precious academic resource, talented graduate students. But these grievances didn't leave the premises of 5 Divinity Avenue, not until March 1962. That's when McClellan, responding to a request by Herb Kelman, called a meeting of the faculty and students to air concerns about the psilocybin project. Kelman asked for the meeting because he had heard from his graduate students that a kind of cult had formed around Alpert and Leary, and some students felt pressure to participate in the drug-taking. Early in the meeting, Kelman took the floor. "I wish I could treat this as a scholarly disagreement, but this work violates the values of the academic community. The whole program has an anti-intellectual atmosphere. Its emphasis is on pure experience, not on verbalizing findings. I'm also sorry to say that Dr. Leary and Dr. Alpert have taken a very nonchalant attitude toward these experiments, especially considering the effects these drugs might have on the subjects. What most concerns me," Kelman concluded, "and others who have come to me, is how the hallucinogenic and mental effects of these drugs have been used to form a kind of insider sect within the department. Those who choose not to participate are labeled as squares. I just don't think that kind of thing should be encouraged in this department." Psychedelic drugs had divided a Harvard department, just as they would soon divide the culture. Alpert responded forcefully, claiming the work was right in the tradition of William James, the department's presiding deity, and that Kelman's critique amounted to an attack on academic freedom. But Leary took a more conciliatory approach, consenting to a few reasonable restrictions on the research. Everyone went home thinking the matter had been closed, until the following morning. The room had been so completely jammed with faculty and students that no one noticed the presence of an undergraduate reporter from the Crimson named Robert Ellis Smith, furiously taking notes. The next day's Crimson put the controversy on page 1. Psychologists disagree on psilocybin research. The day after that, the story was picked up by the Boston Herald, a Hearst paper, and given a much punchier, if not quite as accurate, headline. "Hallucination drug fought at Harvard. 350 students take pills." Now the story was out, and very soon Timothy Leary, always happy to supply a reporter with a delectably outrageous quote, was famous. He delivered a particularly choice one after the university forced him to put his supply of Sandoz psilocybin pills under the control of health services. "Psychedelic drugs cause panic and temporary insanity in people who have not taken them." By the end of the year, Leary and Alpert had concluded that, quote, "these materials are too powerful and too controversial to be researched in a university setting." They announced in a letter to the Crimson they were forming something called the International Federation for Internal Freedom, IFIF, and henceforth would be conducting research under its umbrella rather than Harvard's. They decried the new restrictions placed on psychedelic research, not only at Harvard, but by the federal government. In the wake of the thalidomide tragedy, in which a new sedative given to pregnant women for morning sickness had caused terrible birth defects in their children, Congress had given the FDA authority to regulate experimental drugs. For the first time in American history, the IFIF announced, and for the first time in the Western world since the Inquisition, there now exists a scientific underground. They predicted that a major civil liberties issue of the next decade would be the control and expansion of consciousness. "Who controls your cortex?" they wrote in their letter to the Crimson, which is to say to students. "Who decides on the range and limits of your awareness? If you want to research your own nervous system, expand your consciousness, who is to decide that you can't and why?" It's often said that in the 1960s, psychedelics escaped from the laboratory, but it would probably be more accurate to say that they were thrown over the laboratory wall, and never with as much loft or velocity as by Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert at the end of 1962. "We're through playing the science game," Leary told McClellan when he returned to Cambridge that fall. Now, Leary and Alpert were playing the game of cultural revolution. The larger community of psychedelic researchers across North America reacted to Leary's provocations with dismay and then alarm. Leary had been in regular contact with the West Coast and Canadian groups, exchanging letters and visits with his far-flung colleagues on a fairly regular basis. He and Alpert had paid a visit to Stolaroff's foundation in 1960 or 1961. "I think they thought we were too straight-laced," Don Allen told me. Soon after arriving at Harvard, Leary had gotten to know Huxley, who was teaching for a semester at MIT. Huxley had become extremely fond of the roguish professor and shared his aspirations for psychedelics as an agent of cultural transformation, but worried that Leary was moving too fast and too flagrantly. During his last visit to Cambridge, Huxley would die in Los Angeles in November 1963 on the same day as John F. Kennedy, Huxley felt that Leary had talked such nonsense that I became quite concerned, not about his sanity, because he is perfectly sane, but about his prospects in the world. In a 1992 letter to Betty Eisner, Humphrey Osmond wrote, "Where both Al Hubbard and Aldous Huxley disagreed with Timothy Leary was that they believed that he had got the timescale wrong and that the U.S. had a much greater inertia than he supposed. They both believed, for quite different reasons, that working inconspicuously but determinedly within the system could transform it in the long run. Timothy believed that it could be taken by storm." Soon after Leary announced the formation of the International Federation for Internal Freedom, Humphrey Osmond traveled to Cambridge to try to talk some sense into him. He and Abram Hoffer were worried that Leary's promotion of the drugs outside the context of clinical research threatened to provoke the government and upend their own research. Osmond also faulted Leary for working without a psychopharmacologist and for treating these powerful chemicals as harmless toys. Hoping to distance serious research from irresponsible use, and troubled that the counterculture was contaminating his formerly neutral term, psychedelic, Osmond tried once again to coin a new one. Psychodelitic. I don't need to tell you it failed to catch on. "You must face these objections rather than dissipate them with a smile, however cosmic," Osmond told him. There it was again, the indestructible Leary smile. But Osmond got nothing more than that for his troubles. Myron Stolaroff weighed in with a blunt letter to Leary describing the IFIF as insane and accurately prophesying the crack-up to come. "It will wreak havoc on all of us doing LSD work all over the nation. Tim, I am convinced you are heading for very serious trouble if your plan goes ahead as you have described it to me. And it would not only make a great deal of trouble for you, but for all of us, and may do irreparable harm to the psychedelic field in general." But what exactly was the plan of the IFIF? Leary was happy to state it openly: to introduce as many Americans to the strong psychedelics as it possibly could in order to change the country one brain at a time. He had done the math and concluded that the critical figure for blowing the mind of the American society would be 4 million LSD users, and this would happen by 1969. As it would turn out, Leary's math was not far off. Though closer to 2 million Americans had tried LSD by 1969, this cadre had indeed blown the mind of America, leaving the country in a substantially different place. But perhaps the most violent response to Leary's plans for worldwide mental revolution came from Al Hubbard, who had always had an uneasy relationship with the professor. The two had met soon after Leary got to Harvard, when Hubbard made the drive to Cambridge in his Rolls-Royce, bringing a supply of LSD he hoped to trade for some of Leary's psilocybin. "He blew in with that uniform," Leary recalled, "laying down the most incredible atmosphere of mystery and flamboyance and really impressive bullshit," a subject on which Leary was certainly qualified to judge. "Hubbard started name-dropping like you wouldn't believe, claimed he was friends with the Pope. The thing that impressed me is, on one hand, he looked like a carpetbagger con man, and on the other, he had these most impressive people in the world in his lap, basically backing him. But Leary's legendary charm never had much traction with Hubbard, a deeply conservative and devout man who disdained both the glare of publicity and the nascent counterculture. "I liked Tim when we first met," he said years later, "but I warned him a dozen times about staying out of trouble in the press. He seemed like a well-intentioned person, but then he went overboard. He turned out to be completely no good." Like many of his colleagues, Hubbard strongly objected to Leary's do-it-yourself approach to psychedelics, especially his willingness to dispense with the all-important trained guide. His attitude toward Leary might also have been influenced by his extensive contacts in law enforcement and intelligence, which by now had the professor on their radar. According to Osman, the captain's antipathy toward Leary surfaced alarmingly during a psychedelic session these two shared during this period of mounting controversy. Al got greatly preoccupied with the idea he ought to shoot Timothy, and when I began to reason with him that this would be a very bad idea, I became much concerned he might shoot me. Hubbard was probably right to think that nothing short of a bullet was going to stop Timothy Leary now. As Stolaroff put the matter in closing his letter to Leary, "I suppose there is little hope that with the bit so firmly in your mouth, you can be deterred." By the spring of 1963, Leary had one foot out of Harvard, skipping classes and voicing his intention to leave at the end of the school year when his contract would be up. But Alpert had a new appointment in the School of Education and planned to stay on, until another explosive article in the Crimson got them both fired. This one was written by an undergraduate named Andrew Weil. Weil had arrived at Harvard with a keen interest in psychedelic drugs. He had devoured Huxley's Doors of Perception in high school, and when he learned about the psilocybin project, he beat a path to Professor Leary's office door to ask if he could participate. Leary explained the university rule restricting the drugs to graduate students. Yet, trying to be helpful, he told Weil about a company in Texas where he might order some mescaline by mail. It was still legal at the time, which Weil promptly did, using university stationery. Weil became fascinated with the potential of psychedelics and helped form an undergraduate mescaline group. But he wanted badly to be part of Leary and Alpert's more exclusive club. So when in the fall of 1962, Weil began to hear about other undergraduates who had received drugs from Richard Alpert, he was indignant. He went to his editor at the Crimson and proposed an investigation. Weil developed leads on a handful of fellow students whom Alpert had turned on in violation of university rules. Weil would later write that students and others were using hallucinogens for seductions both heterosexual and homosexual. But there were two problems with his scoop. None of the students to whom Alpert supposedly gave drugs were willing to say so on the record. And the Crimson's lawyers were worried about printing defamatory charges against professors. The lawyers advised Weil to turn over his information to the administration. He could then write a story reporting on whatever actions the university took in response to the charges, thereby reducing the newspaper's legal exposure. But Weil still needed a student to come forward. He traveled to New York City to meet with the prominent father of one of them, Ronnie Winston, and offered him a deal. As Alpert tells the story in Don Latin's Harvard Psychedelic Club, "He went to see Harry Winston, the famous Fifth Avenue jeweler, and he said, 'Your son is getting drugs from a faculty member. If your son will admit to that charge, we'll cut out your son's name. We won't use it in the article.' So young Ronnie went to the dean, and when asked if he had taken drugs from Dr. Alpert, confessed, adding an unexpected fillip, 'Yes, sir, I did, and it was the most educational experience I've had at Harvard.'" Alpert and Leary appeared to be the only Harvard professors fired in the 20th century. Technically, Leary wasn't fired, but Harvard stopped paying him several months before his contract ended. The story became national news, introducing millions of Americans to the controversies surrounding these exotic new drugs. It also earned Andrew Weil a plum assignment from Look magazine to write about the controversy, which spread the story still further. describing the psychedelic scene at Harvard in the third person, Weil alluded to an undergraduate group conducting covert research with mescaline, neglecting to mention he was a founding member of that group. This was not, suffice it to say, Andrew Weil's proudest moment, and when I spoke to him about it recently, he confessed that he's felt badly about the episode ever since and had sought to make amends to both Leary and Ram Dass. 2 years after his departure from Harvard, Alpert embarked on a spiritual journey to India and returned as Ram Dass. Leary readily accepted Weil's apology. The man was apparently incapable of holding a grudge. But Ram Dass refused to talk to Weil for years, which pained him. But after Ram Dass suffered a stroke in 1997, Weil traveled to Hawaii to seek his forgiveness. Ram Dass finally relented, telling Weil that he had come to regard being fired from Harvard as a blessing. "If you hadn't done what you did," he told Weil, "I would never have become Ram Dass." Here, upon their exit from Harvard, we should probably take our leave of Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, even though their long, strange trip through American culture still had a long, strange way to go. The two would now take their show, with its numerous ex-students and hangers-on, on the road, moving the International Federation for Internal Freedom, which would later morph into the League for Spiritual Discovery, from Cambridge to Zihuatanejo, until the Mexican government, under pressure from U.S. authorities, kicked them out, then briefly to the Caribbean island of Dominica, until that government kicked them out, before finally settling for several raucous years in a 64-room mansion in Millbrook, New York, owned by a wealthy patron named Billy Hitchcock. Embraced by the rising counterculture, Leary was invited, along with Allen Ginsberg, to speak at the First Human Be-In in San Francisco, an event that drew some 25,000 young people to Golden Gate Park in January 1967 to trip on freely distributed LSD while listening to speakers proclaim a new age. The ex-professor, who for the occasion had traded in his Brooks Brothers for white robes and love beads and flowers in his graying hair, implored the throng of tripping hippies, the term popularized that year by the local newspaper columnist Herb Kane, to turn on, tune in, drop out. The slogan, which he had first said he'd thought up in the shower, but years later claimed was given to him by Marshall McLuhan, would cling to Leary for the rest of his life, earning him the contempt of parents and politicians the world over. But Leary's story only gets weirder and sadder. Soon after his departure from Cambridge, the government, alarmed at his growing influence on the country's youth, launched a campaign of harassment that culminated in the 1966 bust in Laredo. He was driving his family to Mexico on vacation when a border search of his car turned up a small quantity of marijuana. Leary would spend years in jail battling federal marijuana charges and then several more years on the lam as an international fugitive from justice. He acquired this status in 1970 after his bold escape from a California prison with the help of the Weathermen, the revolutionary group. His comrades managed to spirit Leary out of the country to Algeria into the arms of Eldridge Cleaver, the Black Panther who had established a base of operations there. But asylum under Cleaver turned out to be no picnic. The Panther confiscated his passport, effectively holding Leary hostage. Leary had to escape yet again, this time making his way to Switzerland, where he found luxurious refuge in the chalet of an arms dealer, then, after the U.S. government persuaded Switzerland to jail him, onto Vienna, Beirut, and Kabul, where he was finally seized by U.S. agents and remanded to an American prison, now maximum security and, for a time, solitary confinement. But the persecution only fed his sense of destiny. The rest of his life is an improbable 1960s tragicomedy featuring plenty of courtrooms and jails, 29 in all, but also memoirs and speeches and television appearances, a campaign for governor of California, for which John Lennon wrote and the Beatles recorded the campaign song, Come Together, and a successful, if somewhat pathetic, run on the college lecture circuit teamed up with G. Gordon Liddy. Yes, the Watergate burglar, who in an earlier incarnation as Dutchess County Assistant DA had busted Leary at Millbrook. Through it all, Leary remains improbably upbeat, never displaying anger or, it would seem, from the countless photographs and film clips, forgetting Marshall McLuhan's sage advice to smile always, no matter what. Meanwhile, beginning in 1965, Leary's former partner in psychedelic research, Richard Alpert, was off on a considerably less hectic spiritual odyssey to the East. As Ram Dass and the author of the 1971 classic Be Here Now, he would put his own lasting mark on American culture, having blazed one of the main trails by which Eastern religion found its way into the counterculture and then the so-called New Age. To the extent that the 60s birthed a form of spiritual revival in America, Ram Dass was one of its fathers. But Leary's post-Harvard antics are relevant to the extent that they contributed to the moral panic that now engulfed psychedelics and doomed the research. Leary became a poster boy not just for the drugs, but for the idea that a crucial part of the counterculture's DNA could be spelled out in the letters LSD. Beginning with Allen Ginsberg's December 1960 psilocybin trip at his house in Newton, Leary forged a link between psychedelics and the counterculture that has never been broken, and that is surely one of the reasons they came to be regarded as so threatening to the establishment. Could it have possibly been otherwise? What if the cultural identity of the drugs had been shaped by, say, a conservative Catholic like Al Hubbard? It's difficult to imagine such a counter-history. It didn't help that Leary liked to say things like, LSD is more frightening than the bomb, or the kids who take LSD aren't going to fight your wars, they're not going to join your corporations. These were no empty words. Beginning in the mid-1960s, tens of thousands of American children actually did drop out, washing up on the streets of Haight-Ashbury in the East Village. And young men were refusing to go to Vietnam. The will to fight and the authority of authority had been undermined. These strange new drugs, which seemed to change the people who took them, surely had something to do with it. Timothy Leary had said so. But this upheaval would almost certainly have happened without Timothy Leary. He was by no means the only route by which psychedelics were seeping into American culture. He was just the most notorious. In 1960, the same year Leary tried psilocybin and launched his research project, Ken Kesey, the novelist, had his own mind-blowing LSD experience, a trip that would inspire him to spread the psychedelic word and the drugs themselves as widely and loudly as he could. It is one of the richer ironies of psychedelic history that Kesey had his first LSD experience courtesy of a government research program conducted at the Menlo Park Veterans Hospital, which paid him $75 to try the experimental drug. Unbeknownst to Kesey, his first LSD trip was bought and paid for by the CIA, which had sponsored the Menlo Park research as part of its MKUltra program, the agency's decade-long effort to discover whether LSD could somehow be weaponized. With Ken Kesey, the CIA had turned on exactly the wrong man. In what he aptly called the Revolt of the Guinea Pigs, Kesey proceeded to organize with his band of merry pranksters a series of acid tests in which thousands of young people in the Bay Area were given LSD in an effort to change the mind of a generation. To the extent that Ken Kesey and his pranksters helped shape the new zeitgeist, a case can be made that the cultural upheaval we call the 1960s began with a CIA mind control experiment gone awry. In retrospect, the psychiatric establishment's reaction was probably unavoidable the moment that Humphrey Osmond, Al Hubbard, and Aldous Huxley put forward their new paradigm for psychedelic therapy in 1956-1957. The previous theoretical models used to make sense of the drugs were, by comparison, easy to fold into the field's existing frameworks without greatly disturbing the status quo. Psychotomimetics fit nicely into the standard psychiatric understanding of mental illness. The drug's effects resembled familiar psychoses, and psycholytics could be incorporated into both the theory and the practice of psychoanalysis as a useful adjunct to talking therapy. But the whole idea of psychedelic therapy posed a much stiffer challenge to the field and the profession. Instead of interminable weekly sessions, the new mode of therapy called for only a single high-dose session aimed at achieving a kind of conversion experience in which the customary roles of both patient and therapist had to be reimagined. Academic psychiatrists were also made uncomfortable by the spiritual trappings of psychedelic therapy. Charles Grobe, the UCLA psychiatrist who would play an important role in the revival of research, wrote in a 1998 article on the history of psychedelics that by, quote, blurring the boundaries between religion and science, between sickness and health, and between healer and sufferer, the psychedelic model entered the realm of applied mysticism, a realm where psychiatry, increasingly committed to a biochemical understanding of the mind, was reluctant to venture. With its emphasis on set and setting, what Grobe called the critical extra-pharmacological variables, psychedelic therapy was also a little too close to shamanism for comfort. For so-called shrinks, not entirely secure in their identity as scientists, the slang is short for head shrinkers, conjuring images of witch doctors in loincloths, this was perhaps too far to go. Another factor was the rise of the placebo-controlled double-blind trial as the gold standard for testing drugs in the wake of the thalidomide scandal, a standard difficult for psychedelic research to meet. By 1963, leaders of the profession had begun editorializing against psychedelic research in their journals. Roy Grinker, the editor of the Archives of General Psychiatry, lambasted researchers who were administering, quote, the drugs to themselves and had become enamored with the mystical hallucinatory state, thus rendering them disqualified as competent investigators. Writing the following year in the Journal of the American Medical Association, or JAMA, Grinker deplored the practice of investigators taking the drugs themselves, thereby, quote, rendering their conclusions biased by their own ecstasy. An unscientific aura of magic surrounded the new drugs, another critic charged in JAMA in 1964. It didn't help that some psychedelic therapists, like Betty Eisner, celebrated the introduction of the transcendental into psychiatry and developed an interest in paranormal phenomena. But although there is surely truth to the charge that researchers were often biased by their own experiences using the drugs, the obvious alternative, abstinence, posed its own set of challenges, with the result that the loudest and most authoritative voices in the debate over psychedelics during the 1960s were precisely the people who knew the least about them. To psychiatrists with no personal experience of psychedelics, their effects were bound to look a lot more like psychoses than transcendence. The psychotomimetic paradigm had returned, now with a vengeance. After quantities of bootleg LSD showed up on the street in 1962, 1963, and people in the throes of bad trips began appearing in emergency rooms and psych wards, mainstream psychiatry felt compelled to abandon psychedelic research. LSD was now regarded as a cause of mental illness rather than a cure. In 1965, Bellevue Hospital in Manhattan admitted 65 people for what it called LSD-induced psychoses. With the media now in full panic mode, urban legends about the perils of LSD spread more rapidly than facts. Several of these urban legends have been traced to their source and discredited. For example, a 1967 Newsweek story about six college students tripping on LSD who went blind after staring into the sun turned out to be a hoax concocted by Pennsylvania's State Commissioner for the Blind, Dr. Norman Yoder. According to the governor, who disclosed the hoax, Yoder had, quote, attended a lecture on the use of LSD by children and became concerned and emotionally involved. Yet once introduced into the culture, these urban legends survive and on occasion go on to become true when people tripping on LSD are inspired to imitate them, as has happened in the case of the staring into the sun story. Something similar was often true in the case of ostensibly scientific facts. In one widely publicized study, a researcher reported in the magazine Science that LSD could damage chromosomes, potentially leading to birth defects. But when the study was later discredited, also in Science, the refutation received little attention. It didn't fit the new public narrative of LSD as a threat. Yet it was true that the mid-1960s saw a surge of people on LSD showing up in emergency rooms with acute symptoms of paranoia, mania, catatonia, and anxiety, as well as acid flashbacks, a spontaneous recurrence of symptoms days or weeks after ingesting LSD. Some of these patients were having genuine psychotic breaks. especially in the case of young people at risk for schizophrenia, an LSD trip can trigger their first psychotic episode, and sometimes did. It should be noted that any traumatic experience can serve as such a trigger, including the divorce of one's parents or graduate school. But in many other cases, doctors with little experience of psychedelics mistook a panic reaction for a full-blown psychosis, which usually made things worse. Andrew Weil, who as a young doctor volunteered in the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic in 1968, saw a lot of bad trips and eventually developed an effective way to treat them. He said, "I would examine the patient, determine it was a panic reaction, and then tell him or her, 'Will you excuse me for a moment? There's someone in the next room who has a serious problem.' They would immediately begin to feel much better." The risks of LSD and other psychedelic drugs were fiercely debated during the 1960s, both among scientists and in the press. Voices on both sides of this debate typically cherry-picked evidence and anecdotes to make their case. But Sidney Cohen was an exception, approaching the question with an open mind and actually conducting research to answer it. Beginning in 1960, he published a series of articles that track his growing concerns. For his first study, Cohen surveyed 44 researchers working with psychedelics, collecting data on some 5,000 subjects taking LSD or mescaline on a total of 25,000 occasions. He found only 2 credible reports of suicide in this population, a low rate for a group of psychiatric patients, several transient panic reactions, but, quote, no evidence of serious, prolonged physical side effects. He concluded that when psychedelics are administered by qualified therapists and researchers, complications were, quote, surprisingly infrequent, and that LSD and mescaline were, in his words, safe. Leary and others often cited Cohen's 1960 paper as an exoneration of psychedelics. Yet in a follow-up article published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1962, Cohen reported new and alarming developments. The casual use of LSD outside the clinical setting and in the hands of irresponsible therapists was leading to, quote, serious complications and occasional catastrophic reactions. Alarmed that physicians were losing control of the drug, Cohen warned that, quote, the dangers of suicide, prolonged psychotic reactions, and antisocial acting out behavior exist. In another paper, published in the Archives of General Psychiatry the following year, he reported several cases of psychotic breaks and an attempted suicide, and presented an account of a boy who, after ingesting a sugar cube laced with LSD that his father, a detective, had confiscated from a pusher, endured more than a month of visual distortions and anxiety before recovering. It was this article that inspired Roy Grinker, the journal's editor, to condemn psychedelic research in an accompanying commentary, even though Cohen himself continued to believe that psychedelics in the hands of responsible therapists had great potential. A fourth article that Cohen published in 1966 reported still more LSD casualties, including 2 accidental deaths associated with LSD, one from drowning and the other from walking into traffic shouting, "Halt!" But balanced assessments of the risks and benefits of psychedelics were the exception to what by 1966 had become a full-on moral panic about LSD. A handful of headlines from the period suggest the mood. LSD use charged with killing teacher. Sampled LSD, youth plunges from viaduct. LSD use near epidemic in California. 6 students blinded on LSD trip in sun. Girl 5 eats LSD and goes wild. A thrill drug warps mind, kills. And a monster in our midst, a drug called LSD. Even Life magazine, which had helped ignite public interest in psychedelics just 9 years before with R. Gordon Wasson's enthusiastic article on psilocybin, joined the chorus of condemnation, publishing a feverish cover story titled, LSD, the exploding threat of the mind drug that got out of control. Never mind that the magazine's publisher and his wife had recently had several positive LSD experiences themselves under the guidance of Sidney Cohen. Now the kids were doing it, and it had gotten out of control. With pictures of crazed people cowering in corners, the story warned that, quote, an LSD trip is not always a round trip, but rather could be, quote, a one-way trip to an asylum, a prison, or a grave. There are quotations in this piece that should have set off any editor's bullshit detector. Quote, "When my husband and I want to take a trip together," says the psychedelic mother of four, "I just put a little acid in the kids' orange juice in the morning and let them spend the day freaking out in the woods." As Claire Booth Luce wrote to Sidney Cohen in 1965, LSD has been your Frankenstein monster. Other powerful drugs subject to abuse, such as the opiates, have managed to maintain a separate identity as a legitimate tool of medicine. Why not psychedelics? The story of Timothy Leary, the most famous